we're surrounded by stories that just don't add up. Choices that appear to be baffling, actions that defy logic. But what if there's more to the story? On How Did It Make Sense, we explore the power of learning from experience and digging into the second stories that are always present. We talk to experts from diverse fields who are challenging the way we think about safety, risk, and decision making. Join us as we unlock the lessons hidden within everyday events. Some of these are high risk and some appear to be mundane, but all of them show how we can create a fairer, safer, and more resilient world. Welcome to another episode of How Did It Make Sense, where we explore first stories and second stories. And there's always more to the simple narratives that we hear. And today I've got one of my Lund colleagues, one of my Lund co-students that go to Lund University.
And I have my Black Panthers hoodie on. Sorry, I didn't wear my Lund hoodie.
That's cool. And so it's a little while since we spoke. Probably this summer, actually, in June when we were graduating. And that bit about, you know, make sure you're not the smartest person in the room. I'm not the smartest person in the room. And it's really cool to have you on here, Colette.
That's such a lie. You were always the one.
No,
I remember coming home from our first learning lab and telling my husband, like, so there's this guy and he's already done all the reading somehow. And I was talking about you. I was like, he just knows everything. And I feel like I don't know anything. And I'm so behind.
Anyway. Not at all. And it's really cool. And actually, you know, the diverse experience that we all have. And when you talk about sort of political science and being a cellist and all of the stuff that's there. So Colette, tell people who you are, how you got to where you are, and what do you do, and where people can find you in the real world or in the digital space if they want to get hold of you.
Yeah. So I'm Colette Alexander. And I am a director of engineering at a company called HashiCorp that does cloud and enterprise software, basically automation for software stuff. And I work with SREs. So I'm the director of site reliability engineering at HashiCorp. SRE is like a subset of specialty in the software world that kind of focuses on reliability and safety and software. I went to Lund recently and graduated in your cohort. I've been working in tech for like 13 years. Before that, I was a cellist in rock bands, which means I have like a non-traditional background in terms of like people in the tech world. And I sort of became obsessed with safety while I was working at a company called Spotify. I became obsessed with like the safety world, the resilience engineering world is often how we refer to it. And I have a podcast as well. It's called This Is Fine, and you can find it at thisisfinepod.com. We're on all of the podcast places through that. And I'm so excited to be here.
I'll sound enthusiastic about it, Colette.
I'm excited to be here. I feel a little bit like it's a quiz, but I'm like, did I prepare enough? I think I'm prepared. So,
well, there we go. So, you know, we talk about a first story. So what's the first story version of this account that you're going to talk about?
Yeah. So I wanted to pick something from the software world. True story. I also had a marine story, but then I heard Avi talking, who was also in our class, and I was like, oh, maybe I shouldn't tell a marine one. Maybe I should tell a software one. So I picked one that I think pretty much everybody knows about in the world, which is the CrowdStrike outage that happened last summer, I think it was. So from a software engineering perspective, the first story goes something like, a company releases its software to in a way that involves getting deep down in the kernel of an operating system. And that's how they deliver the software. And people who understand this in the software world, everyone would have been like, that's pretty risky. So you're doing something that's pretty risky, right? And they release a type of software that when they begin to release it, this particular module or thing, new feature that they're releasing, they develop this template and they test it in all of these ways. They are very like, we'll pre-test it on all of these different systems to make sure that it works. And they do that for a little while. And then because those tests went really well, they're like, you know what? For these, we don't really need to do any the same amount of testing. We'll do like half of it, right? Boom. Then they take out the entire global infrastructure of anyone who's running Windows and their software suddenly. So is that a good?
Yeah, no. So
explanation of the first story.
Yeah. So how I would sort of interpret that as sort of Joe Public is, you know, software company shortcuts its testing process because it believes that actually the previous bits work okay. And the little gremlins snuck through the bit that you didn't test.
Yeah.
And as a consequence, it collapses and people can really easily turn around and go, well, why didn't you just follow the full process? Now, I've got a tiny little bit of knowledge about software, and I know that you can't test this stuff in brute force testing. There are just so many permutations. So you've got to make some assumptions. So what's the real story? What's the second story behind this?
Well, and again, I want to preface, like I should have prefaced this before I even started with, I do not work at CrowdStrike. I do not know precisely what happened behind the scenes. And so I'm going off of the public documents that they released and some other sort of commentary, the CEO or somebody just testified in Congress. So I read a lot about that, right? I think what's important to understand, right, is this is a pattern that happens all the time, right? And this was precisely what they were doing constantly beforehand. And that when you think about what CrowdStrike is doing, the value, so CrowdStrike is, they released this software and it's meant to help companies detect cybersecurity issues as quickly as possible. Mm-hmm. And so when we think about the need for speed and delivering something very quickly, it's like they're going to identify patterns that are happening in systems. And they're doing that based off of the most recent threat intelligence they have of other systems that are getting compromised all over the world. And so then they're saying, okay, we're going to make our software detect if this pattern is happening. And you don't want to wait on that. You don't want to like snooze on it. You don't want that to be like the most rigorous, longstanding, because 2 weeks later, that's after all of your customers could have potentially been compromised and they wouldn't know. Right.
So you've got just as a simple bit, you're basically developing a guardian or a guard dog that's looking for patterns that says, I think this is a baddie and we're going to have some false positives because actually we're willing to accept the false positive over the missed truth because of the compromise. And we then become very seduced by the outcomes because actually if your false positive is global as opposed to minor and the behaviors are the same, then actually we could end up judging badly over actually what the system's designed to do.
Well, and they're not delivering value to their customers if they're not moving quickly I think their point, right? Mm-hmm. And so they're constantly developing these patterns, these things, and they're releasing them. They're rigorously testing them at first, and then they might let the guardrails down a little bit because they're trying to iterate and deliver that value quicker, right?
So there's like a trade-off between efficiency and thoroughness then.
A little bit, yeah. Well, but it's also, and this is what to bring it back to our lund times, it's a lot like the Challenger explosion in that like it involves something called the normalization of deviance. The work as we do it just sort of becomes the work over time. Mm-hmm. And it's the acceptable thing culturally to do this thing because of the values that the company holds at the time and the sort of value it's delivering for the company at the time. In the case of the Challenger explosion, right, there was O-ring degradation constantly when the shuttles were coming back. And so, you know, while a lot of people thought, oh, the engineers like tried to stop it, it's like actually they didn't know. And they were constantly accepting that O-ring degradation over time. And it just became a thing where they were like, well, this is always like this. We've accepted this degradation.
We shipped the risk
constantly,
criteria.
Right.
Yeah.
We've constantly been living with this risk. And so why would we assume? And speaking of which, the pressures on the shuttle program at the time were, we need successful launches. We need to put people, like, the value that was sort of the pressure of production that was being placed on them was encouraging that accepting of that risk, right? And so when you think about what's really happening in people's heads, it's not some kind of like, oh, I'm going to totally ignore this huge warning signal flashing bright red in my eyes. It's more like, this is what we do. This is like our job, you know?
It's really cool. I mean, so yes, so this week I was doing some work with the Royal National Lifeboat Institute, and we were just talking about tipping points between what's acceptable or not. And it's that bit of, and this idea, we talk about risk as a loss, but risk has always got a positive. So you sit there and go, let's potentially change the language. What's our risk appetite? And I've said to them, why don't you change your language and say, what's your loss appetite? How, you know, just shifting it that way, because you're already looking at the reward side. What's the value that comes out of this? And because we don't have things go wrong very often, they don't have catastrophic outcomes. We have little blips and we can recover those, that sort of resilience that's there. Then we don't realize the enormity of the gambles that we're playing with, because they don't happen. So what's a bit more about the background behind this sort of the CrowdStrike event into sort of your readings and that? So I
think, you know, there's also this piece of like the way that CrowdStrike, a lot of the uproar after the fact, after this outage happened in the tech community, was you shouldn't be running anything in the kernel of your systems. Like, that's just a bad idea. And duh. Like, it's one of those things where sometimes the hindsight bias is just so apparent, but it's also like, yes, but there's also this case of like, cybersecurity is such a huge problem, and there are only so many ways to detect what's going on, and this is one of the best ways. Like, there's a reason that CrowdStrike decided to build their systems the way that they did, right? I also
local rationality, not just at the sharp end, but at the organizational end as well.
I would consider whoever made choices to architect their products also to be at the sharp end, by the way. To me, to me, in the software industry, the blunt end is executives, right? It's me, actually. I'm a director of engineering. I consider myself maybe in like somewhere in closer to the blunt end than the sharp end, but not totally at the blunt end.
Yeah. There's always a sharp end wherever you are in the system.
Right. And the blunt end folks who are making decisions still have, their fiduciary responsibilities or their responsibilities to shareholders. Like, ultimately, we're all root cause of all things is capitalism, Gareth. We've been through this before.
it's the least worst outcome or the least worst possible bit that's there. And yeah.
So I think, you know, ultimately, the decisions that people are making on the ground when it comes to how thoroughly and rigorously are we going to test, these are things that are often calculated and recalculated. I'm speaking from my own observation, right? The rigorousness of testing harnesses and testing systems is 100% determined by the resources available to the people, whether that's time or money, and also the emphasis on like just speedy delivery to like your product value, right? And in software, we just, as a culture, this is across the board, this is not just CrowdStrike, everybody in software pretty much in like modern software development world values pushing things to production as quickly as possible. You want to have rigorous testing in place, obviously, but you're always hampered by, as you said, what you can test and how rigorously, given the constraints that you have in your systems.
I think one of the bits that I picked up, and I suppose I sort of picked it up from my background as well, but reading Dave Zwiebeck's Beyond Blame, and just talking about the development environment is never as complete as your live environment. And you can't load your development environment in the same way that the live environment is, for a whole bunch of reasons, not least, you know, how much money have you got? Right, I'm going to build a complete mirror. And it's like, well, we can't then load it with the same data. So there's always going to be assumptions and the read across and say, this is good enough. Well, this is where we think it's going to fail. This is how we think we can trigger it to fail. And we make an assumption that the real world behaves the same way as the dev environment that we're in.
And there's not just one real world when you think about CrowdStrike, too. There's thousands of real worlds depending on their customers. So Delta's system probably looks very different than another one of their customers. And it's true in that, like, it took Delta forever to recover. Other companies recovered immediately. Other companies, and that was a function not of CrowdStrike's, like, deployment. It was a function of how those other systems were built to behave and operate. And so that's a whole other thing you can't possibly test for, right? I have a t-shirt that says test and prod or live a lie, courtesy of a CEO of a company called honeycomb.io that works in, like, observability and tracing space. And I think it's like, it's totally true. To some degree, you can't know. And we've developed all sorts of concepts and ways to grapple with that, to manage that. Some of what CrowdStrike said they were doing at the end was around canarying their releases.
So is it like the sort of canary in the mine type
releases
thing?
Yeah, so what you do in our case, right, where I'm at, we would release just to, like, a small subset of what our production systems are and kind of see how things behave, look at the metrics and the stuff that we can see. And then
experimentation,
slowly,
and hypothesis, and fail safes. Yeah.
But in CrowdStrike's case, again, I think because they don't know what all their customers, they can't possibly mirror all of their customer systems, right? Mm-hmm. They're going to put up the best version of a system probably that they can put together that mirrors enough of the characteristics. Mm-hmm. And then they would run it there before they would run it. Or they might run it to some customers that have sort of less infrastructure or business critical things first, before, and do, like, a slow roll out to some of their systems before they roll everything out at once, right? So that's one of the mitigations that they talked about doing afterwards. But even then, some things only behave a certain way when they reach a certain scale in production. And so canaries won't help you there.
It's really interesting, the sort of discussion piece that if, you know, the layperson's view of, hey, we just roll out software and we just stick it on computers and it works. And we don't actually recognize the interactions that exist within much bigger systems, like an airline or a supermarket chain or a delivery system or a healthcare system, that we just assume that, hey, it's Windows, whatever Windows means. And it's a software build. Off you go. Or it's a software platform. But just thinking about all of the stuff that bolts into that and the maturity levels and the calls that need to happen to get stuff in and out, it sort of really boggles the mind as to, it's quite amazing that it works as well as it does.
I mean, any engineer in the modern day software world will tell you it's a miracle anything works at all on the internet. So, and I second that. And the miracle really is not, it's people. It's the folks who are working hard to keep that, like make that the case constantly, right?
So talk a little bit more about that then. So how is it that your resilience engineers, your people, how is it that they work around this? Because there's technology that's telling them something, but they've then got to interpret that and then work out who needs to know why and how do we get hold of them. So how do it, you know, it goes ping, right? How do you deal with that as a company?
I think,
or as an org, it doesn't matter who it is, but you know, generally, so just sort of inform the audience here.
Yeah,
how do software systems manage that?
To get a little philosophical first, it's important to recognize that when we say resilience, we mean a specific thing. So robustness is something that you can build into a system that you can plan for ahead of time. It's sort of looking at the problems that you see and saying, you know what, we're heading into the holidays. We're going to build in the ability for us to scale the capacity of our systems to manage our holiday traffic, right? That would be making your system more robust to holiday traffic. Resilience is we don't know what could happen to sort of take things down or make things difficult to understand. How do you generate resilience in your systems? You create adaptive capacity in your systems, and the only adaptive capacity that exists is humans. So machines are never going to have adaptive capacity. Like, that's not a thing that they can do.
Is that because of creativity and imagination?
Yes. And I think cognitive, there's like a piece of cognitive ability that AI, that, you know, any machine just does not have the ability to reason on the fly and have instinct too about what's going on. When you think about the deep levels of expertise that the people who build systems of any kind have in those systems, it's, you can't just sort of like write a couple pages of a doc and then like, boom, read it and boom, you have that expertise, right? There's something inside of their cognition and their understanding based on that expertise that allows them to react in unplanned situations and bring their expertise to the fore to solve problems, right? Ultimately, when we have incidents in at my company or any company that's having incidents, you need people.
I mean, all of them.
Yeah. You need people to help solve the problem. There are companies out there, I think, who try to sell like, we're going to AI incident respond. No. You're just programming runbooks for things that you can plan ahead for. Like,
they're building robustness, not resilience.
Exactly.
So how do you scale resilience then? Now, if you could answer that, you'd probably make a shed load of money. But so I would say that, you know, it's any sort of dynamic, creative, adaptive space, scaling is not easy. And it's one of the challenges I face in developing instructors to teach this stuff dynamically in high-risk industries, high-performance teamwork, is it's not a five-minute job.
No, and learning is a constant process. I mean, I think for me, fundamental to my beliefs is how do I create a culture of learning in the organizations that I operate in, not just in my management chain, right, whoever happens to report up to me, but across the entire organization. If we do not create a culture of learning and curiosity about our systems and about what's happening, then we will not have the resilience we need when something unexpected happens. And so that is to me like the first strategy that I, you know, try to underpin whenever I arrive in any organization.
So I'm going to do a smokes on you. What does learning mean?
I know, right? And I think it's like the pornography, I'll know it when I see it. I think everybody has a sense of when they've learned something and understands what learning is. And yet, I think sometimes when people ask, what does learning mean? What they're really asking is, what are signs? What are metrics that I can attach to learning?
And how do I pay for that and measure its return?
Right. How do I make it more efficient, Gareth? How do I make people learn faster and better? And, you know, that is. So what we do. I'm a big proponent of learning from incidents, which through in-depth incident analysis. So this is where, you know, instead of doing what we would call like a pretty bog standard post-incident review that like happens at the end of an incident and like seriously engineers write them and then they like go in Google Docs filed away forever and nobody ever looks at them, right? So what we do
is... You've got a big data repository, not a learning repository.
Exactly. And so what we want to do is we want to tell a story. And so you interview people, you get like really in-depth, like interesting sort of descriptions, rich qualitative data about the situation. And then you put together a report that tells the story of the incident and the systems behind the incident. Because, and let me tell you this, like engineers love nothing more. It's like a little bit like rubbernecking at a car accident, but like we love reading incident reports. I was just reading the CrowdStrike incident report again today to like refresh my memory before I came on. It's compelling. It's compelling. You're like, because you like know, it's like watching a horror
movie. So is it compelling because
it can happen? But I don't, I don't know. It's, I don't know why. But if you can embed learning about your systems in that report, so like knowledge, like deep expertise, so you're interviewing the experts in those systems, you're putting some of that expertise as much as you can in that story so that anybody reading it will suddenly know way more about the systems they operate and operate in and around every day. That's a good tactic, I think.
Cool. So one of the bits that came out of my research was about the storytelling piece and the skill that goes into asking the right questions and knowing how to tell the story. So when you were talking just there, I was thinking there's push learning and pull learning. You know, you push stuff from the organization, learn this, you have to learn it. But actually what you've just described is people want to pull learning. And that means there's an innate piece that says, I know that I have gaps in my knowledge, and the only way I can learn, fill those gaps, and I'm not going to fill them all, is go and find somebody else and learn from them. So do you recruit for learning approach as organizations? So you've got technical skills. You can do the codey stuff, you know, pilots uppy, downy, lefty, righty type stuff. But, you know, do you have a criteria or something that says, we're going to recruit people who want to learn?
I prefer to assume that everybody wants to learn. And okay. with the understanding that not everybody, like, it's okay if not everybody wants to learn. I would rather create such a strong learning culture that they self opt out of it if they're really like not into it, right? Go somewhere else is fine. I think I do have to recruit in my SRE sort of orgs. I do have to recruit people who are okay with generating that culture as much as I am. And I do think that that is really important because it's one thing to want to learn. It's another thing, especially for engineers, software engineers, I think they're taught very frequently and pressured a lot, even by society. Like Amazon just released this thing the other day that was like, oh, did you know that most engineers only spend an hour coding and the rest is all wasted? Like they sort of insinuated it was all wasted time. And it's like, okay. So also this was a sales pitch for AI. So fair, right? You're like, we want to make your life more efficient, but it's like, okay, but that's also ridiculous. And I would recruit the people who know that that's a ridiculous statement, right? That it's your value as an engineer is partly coding. So I only recruit people who can build software, but I recruit people who understand that the hardest part about building software isn't you're typing on a keyboard. It is all of the other stuff around it. The knowledge you have to have, the context you have to have, the business context you have to have and share, like all of those things, that is what makes building software hard. And so those are the people that I tend to gravitate towards recruiting in my particular org.
Interesting. What you just said there, this reminds me of a blog from John Flack talking about abstraction. And it's one of the things that I spend a lot of time trying to explain to people why a depth of knowledge is needed around a topic is because you can then look at a scene, abstract it up to whatever theory or concept, and then take it down somewhere else. And day before, I was doing some stuff, I say, with the RNLI, and we were talking about single, double loop, triple loop learning, of going further back into the system. And one of my instructors said, well, what does that look like in a workshop? I get that theoretically, but what does it look like? And I said, well, the simulation tool we use, it's got a simple bit that we move batteries from one part of the spacecraft to another. And there's time delays. The interface sucks. There's no indication as what's going on. I mean, it's really, really well, badly designed. You know, sort of counterintuitively, it's a really sucky human interface, machine interface, intentionally. And so I said, you know, the first loop learning would be better, pay more attention, make sure you communicate. Second loop might be, let's put some indicators to tell you there's a battery in the shaft and it's moving. Let's teach people about closed loop communications. Right, I'm sending the battery. Is it clear? Yes. Battery's in transit. It's arrived. It's now clear. So that would be the double loop. Triple loop is start from scratch and rebuild the interface. And so it's that. And I'd never really considered that until Andrea said, what do you mean by this? And it's like, all right, here we go. But I would never have thought about promoting that as an answer or, you know, as something that's out there. And I think there's that bit that you can take ideas. And that's why I talk about creativity. It's that, and that abstraction is, if you understand the base level, how a system works, generally works, then you can nuance it, theory, and then come back down again. I think, you know, what you're saying about your learning people, the knowledge that they're capturing and developing from learning lots of other things,
yep,
then applies in here. So how does so just on that then, different bit, how does music apply to your work?
I wish it applied more. I played a show last Friday. I just like improvised for a friend at her studio space. I think for me, music really applies to my job as a manager and in sort of management and leadership, in that like I, you know, my work for most of my 20s, I played in rock bands. And when you're in a band, like everybody has a role. When you're on tour, everybody has a job to do. Often we have multiple jobs to do. You need to be able to, there's this thing about loving the people that you work with when mm-hmm. you're on stage and being willing to show up and kind of generate enough safety to play well together. You cannot play well if you do not have safety. Safety right? Like, because if you're constantly afraid that somebody's going to like bite your head off for making a mistake or for, then you're just going to be constantly overly tense.
You need all of your cognitive capacity to play.
Right. And I think, you know, one of the things that I tell my engineers a lot in our world where we're trying to encourage this learning and encourage this growth in the rest of the organization around reliability is we're here to make people safe, but we're not here to make them comfortable necessarily.
Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah.
And I think I learned a lot about that feeling and that set of values from being in a band that mm-hmm. was ostensibly there to help. I mean, we're all growing. I was often the youngest person in a band. And I often was
you had multiple bands then. So you got to do multiple learnings.
Yeah. Yeah. Every band is it's like living a new life. It's like going to a different summer camp. Every tour. And I would even say, every tour is different, right? Like every tour has a different vibe. So I think there's that. And the level of responsibility and care you have for people, like, and I, again, also had to learn that somewhat the hard way. I wasn't always the easiest person to be on tour with. Like anybody, you always have tough times, or it's hard to be away, or it's hard to adjust to new environments and new people. But ultimately, like the level of care and the level of safety that we had to provide for one another in order to play together, that was incredibly sacred. And I think I learned a lot about that there, and it helped me be a good manager and understand the right dynamics to have on a team, right? Cool. Not to avoid conflict, but to work through it and to, you know.
Well, conflict's just, you know, it's this, people think that conflict is about sort of aggression and sort of this, but it's just a difference of opinion.
Yeah.
And we can agree to disagree. There we go. Conflict disappears because I'm in that. So when you were talking about the music piece, it reminded me of one of the things. I love being on stage, and I have no idea what I'm like on stage because when I'm in the flow, I'm in the flow.
Yeah.
And it's that bit. So how do you, you know, I'm guessing the same thing happens in incidents. If people are really zoned in and they're in the flow, how do you go and capture the learning then?
Well, you don't do it till after, right?
Well, you obviously, yeah, because you can't do it because you're busy doing, yeah. doing. You know.
The point of during an incident, the point is not to learn. The point is to to get
is to
the incident
fix.
Over. Yeah. And I think, like, but I also think that, like, that deep flow and providing that ability for engineers to be in flow is part of the job of my teams as well. So one of my teams does incident response, like helps with incident response. So they basically do incident command for incidents, which
okay.
means that
oh, cool.
there
yeah.
are always like other teams involved in an incident if their stuff is broken. But like somebody from my org is involved in sort of helping sort of make the
coordination
circus
across at a high level.
They're the circus director. They're hurting all the
connects us across systems. Yeah.
Yeah. And that is such an important job to help engineers have flow, to keep them kind of protected from disruptions that are unnecessary, yeah. all of that stuff. Right.
Have you tried doing this? Have you tried leaving?
I mean, in fairness, what we like to talk about, right. I think we talked about this in the first episode of my podcast is like the people who pop their heads in asking questions during those times. It's because they need something, right? They are also, yeah. again, the sharp end of something. So what you need to think about when you're having those situations, I think, is like, who is not getting information that needs it? And yeah. how do we figure that out? And that's another reason why we have that support mechanism for folks involved in incidents, because it's really important that they're able to focus on getting the incident over while somebody else manages the comms, explaining to customers or communicating with CEOs,
we
right?
role clarity in a team. Who would have thought it?
Shocking. Shocking.
Excellent. Well, thank you for all of these insights about sort of the software world and music and Challenger and things. We sort of end the session with what are the bits that you'd recommend people go away and read or watch or consume knowledge to help them in their learning. So what would you recommend? And it doesn't matter, you know, 1, 2, 3, I don't care. We, you know, there's plenty of space on the show notes. So what would you do? What would you recommend?
This is such a, you know, so I think if you're interested in safety or you're involved in safety, but not in this, you aren't familiar with the software world, but you're curious, I recommend going to read how.complexsystems.fail, which was written by Richard Cook, and is a sort of fundamental, it's a beautiful...
That's his paper, isn't it?
It is. He wrote a paper, but it's also just like a website with the text on it that
okay,
has...
I didn't know that. Okay.
How.complexsystems.fail. It's just a list of stuff. But it is, I think, a wonderful entry point into the world of safety that I send to people, software engineers who are interested in it, all sorts of other people who are curious about what I do. I feel like it's a great summary of the space that we're in, I guess. What else would I recommend? I think, you know, I'm a big fan. I like to approach things from, I'm a very strange bird in the engineering, software engineering community, because I really like to approach things from a people perspective. So I really love ethnography, and I really love thinking about things from an ethnographic perspective. My favorite resource that I used that inspired my thesis at Lund was Lee Clark's, what is the book called? I'm going to like, it's usually like on my bedside.
It's off the top of my mind.
Oh my goodness.
It's about silly systems.
It's
or,
called
no.
Mission Improbable.
Oh, Mission Improbable. Yeah. That's different.
And relatedly, Lee Clark wrote a book wrote a paper with Charles Perrow. And I was describing it to people the other day, and they were like, oh, wow. It's a banger of a paper, as we like to say in our nerdy academic world. And it's about... it's about Lilco, how there was almost a nuclear power plant built on Long Island, and they didn't build it because some activists made them test their
was
evacuation
plan. Was that about
plan.
The exfil piece? Yeah, the get people out when it all goes horribly wrong.
Yeah, so they made this this basically activist group made them test their evacuation plans if something went wrong. And this was before the nuclear power plant was turned on. And it went horribly wrong. It was just like none of it worked. And so the nuclear power plant never got turned on. And so Lee Clark writes about fantasy documents. I think
still what I was thinking of fantasy documents.
Fantasy documents. And I think like these things, I love approaching thinking about safety from the lies we tell ourselves, the ways that humans behave in order to kind of get through. And I really love to understand those sorts of sociological behaviors in my work. So those are the things I recommend.
Brilliant.
Also listen
Brilliant.
To my podcast. Thanks. This is thankpod.com. Sorry, I'm going to plug it again.
No, absolutely. Go for it. It'll be in the show notes as well. The bit about sort of fantasy documents reminded me of Nipin Anand talking about the Costa Concordia and the belief that, you know, cruise liners don't sink. So, you know, and the validation of the evacuation or the mustering drills that are there. And you sit there and go, they don't validate the mustering with 4,500 people on board those vessels. They do scale musterings. Yeah. And you think, imagine what it must be like at, you know, 10 o'clock at night, it's dark, the lights are out, and you've got to go and try and muster 4,500 people and make sure you haven't left anybody behind? Really? You know, but don't worry, we'll sign off and say that we can do this.
Yeah.
And it's that bit of, yeah. You've said you can do it. We believe you can do it, but we know you can't.
Yeah.
And so it's quite amazing that those things do occur in the way they do, because you can't scale that sort of stuff so easily. So it's really cool that somebody tried it and they failed and go, right, in that case, we're not going to do this.
Yeah.
We're not going to do this. So excellent, Colette. Thank you very much for your time. It's great to chat to you again. And until the next time, are you going to London in January?
I don't think so. I wish I could. I have a 2 and a 4-year-old. Well, you know, I had a baby in the middle of the program, and now he's 2.
I broke your arm as well, and there was a whole bunch of stuff that went on, and it was really...
It was insane. I can't believe I made it through. So, I don't think I'll make it this. I yearn for the day when I can go to Learning Lamps for fun. It'll happen soon.
Maybe we should get an online get-together with everybody, and let's get a Zoom chat going, so...
That would be great.
Awesome. Thank you very much, Colette.
Thank you.
Take care, and we'll catch you soon.
You too.